This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Monica Prasad, a professor of sociology and faculty fellow for the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University. She recently wrote an essay in Contemporary Sociology, Problem-Solving Sociology. It's a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. This is the first podcast I've ever done, so a new experience for me.
We'll try and make it a gentle one.
I don't have a better joke than that, so let's just move on.
insert a good joke.
Yeah, right.
We told you there would be editing.
Yeah, problem-solving sociology. Tell us, what's it about?
Okay, so the basic idea is that sociologists are really, really good at identifying problems and bringing problems to attention. You read all these ethnographies that just break your heart and give you nowhere to go. And so the idea is that if we really are the science of society, we have to be able to say something about, well, how do you actually solve these problems? What do you actually do with this, you know, beautiful ethnography of poverty that you have done in the US or in the world? What happens next? And it's not that sociologists don't talk about change. Of course, we talk about change all the time. But I think it is the case that there's sort of this this hidden message. Like, I think I once had a grad student who came into me, and he said he was a first generation student. He said that when he was in college, sociology felt really liberatory because this was the only discipline that actually talked about things like class or, you know, things like race or, you know, structure, things like structure. And so it felt like it was actually naming important problems. And then he got to grad school and he said after a few years, he almost felt like quitting because it seemed that no matter what you did, capital was always going to get you in the end. Yeah. You know, the policy proposals never are going to work. The people who suggest them are just being reductive and they're not really taking on the big structural problem. Every problem is structural. There's nothing you can really do.
Right.
So I think that, you know, I think there is a sort of like a hidden message that we sometimes get. And so what I wanted to do is just to call into more conscious attention that there is actually a lot of really great work in sociology that tries to solve social problems while also moving sociological theory forward. And then to try to figure out how to help people who want to do that do it. So that's what this attempt is about.
And concretely, what does it involve? Like, let's say someone likes the idea of engaging sociology in a problem-solving way. How do they put that into action?
So I'm trying to figure that out too. So this is a hopefully a dialogue that we can have over the next few years about how exactly do you do this. I recently wrote an article for Contemporary Sociology that thinks through, well, what have some people who have managed to do this, how do they actually do it? So one of the things I suggest is we should be studying not just the victims of social problems, but also the quote-unquote villains. You know, it's very understandable that if you want to study poverty, you will go study poor people, right? But it's kind of, it's almost a trap in a way. Because, so you study poor people, and you know, you immerse yourself in the world of these people. And of course, it's necessary and important. But it's also limited because what you become an expert in is the behavior of poor people, which is not the same thing as studying the things that lead to poverty, some of which happen very far from what poor people are actually doing. So that's one thing I suggest, which is think about studying the villains. Think about the people who are actually creating the problem. Figure out their world. Why are they seeing things in this way? What can happen to change it? What are their constraints? What's leading them to do this? So that's one thing. Another thing that I suggest is to think about comparison, to think about a site where the problem has actually been solved, and then compare it to a site where it hasn't been solved. And that is a useful method because it actually gets you around this problem that a lot of people who study social problems have, which is, on the one hand, if you study a social problem, you emphasize the things that are wrong, and you end up leaving this picture that is very, very negative. And then on the other hand, to respond to that, sometimes you have scholars saying, well, we need to think about the things that are actually functional in the setting. And so you try to do that, and then you run into the danger of romanticizing the setting and not really talking about the problems. This happens all the time in scholarship on India, say, you know, where people will try to focus on child marriage or, you know, various kinds of problems with sexism or whatever. And others will say, well, you're just falling into the trap of neocolonialism. You're not looking at India in its entirety, right? And, you know, this happens in urban ethnography as well. So it's just a common problem if you're actually trying to study social problems. So this is a way to sort of avoid that. So, you know, there are various lessons that I suggest in this this essay that I've written. But this whole idea, this whole project is kind of a work in progress. And one thing that I'm doing, I got some money from the NSF to hold a set of workshops for students in the early stages of grad school. So these are dissertation proposal development workshops that are open to students in the first few years of grad school who have not yet defended a dissertation proposal. And so we're going to bring in students and sort of workshop their proposals and try to figure out, well, how can you make this a kind of problem-solving project? How can you try to do this in a way that will actually get published in peer-reviewed journals? How can you do this in a way that will actually allow you to form a long-term community that is trying to solve this problem? So that's where the initiative is right now. And like I said, it's very much a work in progress. So I am very, very open to hearing from people who are interested in this and want to think about what the next step should be.
So wait, there's an opportunity for graduate students to, what can they do? Can you tell us a little more about what this opportunity entails for graduate students?
Yeah, so if it's possible to put up the web link for the call for applications on this podcast, that would be great.
We'll do it. Sure.
Yeah, so we're having a couple of workshops. So what it's going to be is a workshop this year in November 29th or December 6th are the dates, which will be sort of a preliminary workshop that kind of lays out some of the thinking behind what have people who have managed to try to solve problems while also doing basic sociology, how have they managed to do this? And then we're also going to workshop the students' proposals. And we have various faculty facilitators in addition to me who are going to be there, who are going to be workshopping students' proposals. And then we're going to give them a series of sort of exercises for them to go home and do over the next 5 or 6 months. And we bring them back into Evanston in May. And we, at that point, they should have a fuller dissertation proposal, a draft, which we will then workshop more thoroughly. So that's amazing. The basic idea right now. And, you know, I think it'll be really good for them from the point of view of, first of all, getting feedback on research design at a very, very early stage. You know, it often is the case that you know, students go off and do something and then come back and workshop what they did. And, you know, the workshop will say, well, it would have been really great had you done this, you know, and I always think, well, you know, it's helpful, but, you know, this is what I did, you know, so it would be good if it would be good for them to get this feedback at a very early stage in research design. It'd also be really great for them, I think, to meet each other, to meet other people who are actually interested in this kind of, you know, thinking about, well, how do we do this? How do we manage to actually use sociological theory to solve problems, use problems to actually move sociological theory forward? So those are the goals of the workshop.
Well, if I can take a moment and just give my endorsement of Monica Prasad workshops, I went to one, and it was a lovely experience. And yeah, it was wonderful meeting people. We had a couple participants on our show, Benjamin Shestakovsky and Robert Francis. We brought on. It was wonderful meeting them, and it was a great exercise. So.
Yeah, and you guys were the guinea pigs, so this will be much, much better. Yeah.
Well, it was a wonderful experience. I don't think there was much to improve on. So if you found ways to improve it, wonderful. But it was a wonderful experience, and for sure, anybody who's listening that might be interested, go to our show page. We'll put it up on the blog of theannexpodcast.com. So I have a question though about problem solving sociology. So how do we deal with, like, the a priori commitments that sometimes move us to take on social problems, right? And our view of social problems can sometimes be premised on the view that something is a problem that needs to be solved, or we assume that the locus of a problem exists somewhere. What about the argument that if you go right to problem solving, there's the possibility that you put on some blinders? You can become fixated on answers or particular solutions or particular views of a problem. If those premises are faulty, you know, it might not be as fruitful a process.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, absolutely. But that particular danger that you're describing isn't different from any other way of starting a dissertation. You know, you're always going to have certain premises that you go in with, and it's quite possible that in the course of it, they will get challenged. So the one thing that I think is different about problem-solving sociology from perhaps other ways to do sociology that addresses social problems is that I am very, very committed to the attempt to be objective. Now, we are all sociologists, so we know that it is not really possible to be objective. Nevertheless, I do think that you have to allow what you are seeing, you have to allow the data to try to speak to you and to try to change your mind. You might be completely wrong. You know, you might get in there and you might discover that, in fact, raising the minimum wage is a bad idea. And you have to let yourself be open to that. Yeah, so I think that as sociologists and as scientists, that's the part of our heritage that we have to take very, very seriously. Because if raising the minimum wage does lead to losing jobs, we need to know that. You have to take that absolutely seriously. It doesn't help anyone at all if you aren't allowing your premises to be questioned. You know, but I would argue that that is not different from any other kind of sociology that we do. You know, sometimes people will say about problem-solving sociology, well, who actually gets to define what is the problem? And I don't think that that is as much of an issue as people sometimes think it is. You know, on the one hand, obviously it's the analyst who decides what is the problem, and you sort of, the best way to kind of respond to the issue that, well, you have blinders, you don't really see the issue. The best way to do it is to make a sincere and genuine attempt and then let others criticize you. You know, let others show through the process of peer review, through the process of discussion, how your perspective was limited. You know, that's a more sort of, it's a more genuine way of engagement than trying to pretend that you can ever get to a position where you do not have blinders in the first place.
So I thought it was interesting that you mentioned, you know, minimum wage, because there actually was a study after, I forget if Seattle raised its minimum wage, and they hired a team of economists in advance to study it. And they chose people who they thought would be sympathetic to, I mean, they didn't go to, like, you know, Milton Friedman or something like that. And their report basically showed that it hurt low wage workers because they ended up getting their hours cut. It didn't necessarily lead to fewer people being employed, but it did lead to a lot more people working 30 hours instead of 40 hours. And they published that. Although, interestingly enough, a second team, you know, kind of at the last minute, the city council tried to recruit a second team to write up a report exonerating the policy change. So what you're saying has actually happened, and so it makes it a good example. Something I'm wondering is, in my reading of your paper, you're talking about problem solving, and it feels very exploratory. It's like, here's some issue, racism, poverty, eviction, whatever, and we want to go in and we want to figure out what's up with that. And then when it comes to the minimum wage, that's like a very concrete policy. So that's something where you can imagine people passing a minimum wage hike, and then we could look and we could see what's the impact of it. It's different from saying, let's study poverty, or let's study the problem of low wage work or something like that, right? So it's a difference between a problem and a potential solution. And so to kind of give my thoughts on this focus, what I could really say is, what's the difference, or conversely, what's the overlap between problem solving social science and program evaluation social science, right? Because there's a long tradition of, you know, the government creates a program, or at least somebody wants to pilot test a program, and then they hire a social scientist to find out, does this program work, right? We did this pilot test and we want to find out, does it work? And that's true whether it's, you know, mandatory arrests for domestic violence calls, or, you know, or some of the other ones that have been done. I mean, that's a famous one, the minimum wage thing, the Medicaid expansion in Oregon, you know, various things where there's a policy change and then there's program evaluation to see if it works.
Yeah. So program evaluation. So one thing, one of the incentives to do this is that I think there are things that sociologists know about society that other people don't know. That's the premise of this. And that's, I guess I would say, my hope for sociology. If we are the ones who actually study society, there ought to be things that we know about society. So the idea is that if we do actually sort of rifle through the treasure chest of sociological ideas, we will see things that other people who try to solve these problems do not.
Well, I mean, that's a good argument as to why we, as compared to just economists or just, you know, public policy scholars or, you know, think tankers or whatever, should be doing this. But I had more in mind the issue of, your article feels very much exploratory. And I don't mean that the article itself is exploratory. I mean that you're laying out an agenda for essentially exploratory research of, like, here's a problem, what might be done about it? And then there's another type of, so basically here's a dependent variable, what leads to the dependent variable, whether or not it's qualitative or quantitative. And then another way to look at it is, here's a potential solution. You know, oh, and that I remember the other one, it's marriage promotion, right? So the George W. Bush administration pushed marriage promotion as a potential problem, you know, coming out of, you know, McClanahan and Sandifer and everything, arguing that marriage is a big part of poverty. And then the marriage promotion program evaluation came to basically different conclusions than the older stuff on marriage per se. And that if you look at both literatures together, it looks like marriage is important, but we can't do anything about it. So anyway, I view it almost like exploratory versus confirmatory. You know what I'm saying?
I would say that both of those sound to me like problem solving. Definitely there's this exploratory, theoretical, kind of innovative angle to it. In terms of program evaluation, I think I would say that right now it's the case that a certain method has the lock on program evaluation. You know, you have to go out and do randomized control trials. Yep. And right now, I think we are in the early stages of a literature that is starting to show why that is not the only way to do program evaluation. So there are these really interesting studies where ethnographers will go in and kind of look at the program evaluation and find, you know, the kind of things that you would expect, like that people are falsifying the actual documents the study is dependent on, or people are using the money in ways that the program evaluators didn't expect. So I think that there's a role to play for sociologists in that as well. But I guess I do think that I think the most most theoretically exciting work for me is probably going to be in the sort of thinking through potential solutions part of it.
Yeah, in the essay, I like the line where you talk about how the policy suggestion of books feels tacked on. I'm a little bit more skeptical of the idea that if we take a problem-solving approach from the prospectus stage forward, that it'll solve it. Because if you talk to, like, policy intellectuals, who you know, aren't coming out of kind of a letters and science, basic science tradition, but their whole point is to come up with policy proposals and policy problems. They will also talk about the last chapter problem, where, you know, they'll say like they have a problem with like the last chapter, where it's much easier even for people who effectively their entire disciplinary DNA or, you know, occupational DNA is based on the idea of problem solving. They still say that it's much easier to describe a problem than it is to come up with the last chapter. And, you know, the last chapter feels contrived even to them.
No, there's no, like, you know, it's not a magic wand, right? It's not like we just sprinkle the words problem solving sociology and suddenly everything is easy, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea is just that we try to consciously examine sociological theory in ways that might be able to help us solve contemporary problems. You know, so, and I give various examples in the essay of people who actually have managed to do it. I mean, you know, nobody has really managed to solve poverty yet. But there are examples of people who have done research in ways that taught us about society, taught us things about society that we didn't know, and also made real contributions to how we think about sorts of problems. You know, some of the work that I talk about in the essay, and that is some of the most exciting work that I have seen in sociology today, is this work that is being done by some assistant professors, really junior professors around the country, on subnational ways of thinking about state capacity. So these are folks who sort of went in thinking, well, how, if the problem is corruption, say, how do you actually create a meritocratic bureaucracy, one that is not corrupt? And are coming up with some interesting ideas about where the focus should be, what we should study next. And it's never, you know, I think the wrong way to evaluate this approach would be to say, well, is there somebody who in their dissertation solved poverty? Obviously, that's not going to happen. You know, that's not the point.
I'm going to ask that at the next dissertation defense, like, why should we give you your doctorate if you haven't solved poverty?
Yeah, so, you know, so the way to think about it is, did it actually move the conversation forward in a way that actually helps us figure out, well, how might you actually solve this? Did it actually teach us something about society that we didn't know before? And I think we do have examples in sociology of works that managed to do both of those things. You know, one of the, I guess, the canonical example that I talk about in the essay is Peter Evans. He gives us this way of thinking about industrialization that we didn't have before. It's perfectly rooted in theoretical sociology. You know, draws on standard theory. It tells us something important about how poor societies might go on the path towards becoming rich. Now, it's not the case that, you know, you can go in and suddenly create an embedded autonomous agency. That's not the case, you know, but it does lead you one step forward. It did, in fact, help to orient the attention of aid agencies onto things like governance, for example. So, so the lesson or the question is, well, how do you draw from these examples of people who have actually done it? And what kinds of lessons can you distill from that as to how someone who wants to do it might be able to do it?
Nice. All right. Well, we're at 25. Can you think of anything else that we might want to ask?
Wow, I didn't think I was going to have enough to say, but yeah. It turns out I have a lot to say. I guess one thing.
These always go way longer than people think they're going to go. It's almost reliably. So.
Yeah, you guys are good at making people talk.
Well, it's scholars. It's pretty easy. We just sit back and let it happen.
I guess so.
We're not the ones talking.
So I wanted to mention that this whole thing started partly because I was chair of the comparative historical sociology section a few years ago, and we did this this little kind of essay on how can comparative historical sociology be a little more involved with social issues. And what really surprised me was how much of a backlash there was to trying to be more involved with social issues.
What were the arguments?
So there were a lot of different arguments, some of which I didn't think were all that great. But the best argument that I heard was that doing things this way instrumentalizes knowledge. Mm. You know, it's a sort of utilitarian approach to knowledge, or a utilitarian approach to the academy, to what sociology ought to be. I can understand that fear. You know, there is this sort of knowledge for knowledge's sake wish in sociology and in the academy in general. And I think the main thing that I want to say about that is that I think I don't think the two are in competition, because I think that if sociology becomes the kind of discipline that can actually solve problems, or, you know, that can even get us some of the way there, I think that actually opens up the space for sociologists in academia. In one of these debates that we were having in the comparative historical sociology section, I gave the example of Barrington Moore, who decided to do his research because of a very practical question that was moving everyone then, which is, how do you understand the rise of fascism? There was this massive social problem that had occurred, and he tried to figure out what was causing it. This attempt was so interesting and so successful that it actually created space in the academy for comparative historical sociologists, including comparative historical sociologists who don't want anything to do with solving problems at all. So I think it's basically, you have to think about the ecology of what creates or what sustains academia in general. If some of us are out there trying to solve problems that people care about, it creates space in the academy for others who don't want to solve problems at all. So yeah, that's the hope. I mean, imagine if sociologists, you know, actually did manage to solve a problem that people care about. So
then we could spend a lot of time talking about agency and structure.
Right, exactly. Exactly. How we actually solved the problem, how we did not solve the problem. Yeah.
I suppose so, yeah. The only thing that I would that would concern me, but you're right, you make a good point that it's true of any endeavor, is just sort of getting a tunnel vision and committing to a problem that it in fact is not the root cause of whatever source of social distress you're trying to engage.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's very important to leave yourself open to finding that out. I think that, like I said earlier, that danger is present in any kind of topic you're going to be doing. But I also think that there is a danger in waiting until you have figured it all out. Mm. You know, I think sometimes there's this sense that, okay, first I'm going to figure out what the answer is, and then I will apply it. First I'm going to figure out what the true problem is, and then I'm going to try to resolve that problem. And of course, you do have to do some of that to figure out what you think the problem is. There's a danger in that this kind of thinking doesn't really solve problems, or it doesn't really get you to the answer of what the root problem is. You know, you're going to spend your life trying to figure out, well, what is actually the correct problem behind this? People say, well, yes, that's what you should do instead of prematurely taking a decision. But by doing that, you have actually already taken a decision. You have taken a decision to not be engaged in the problems of your days. You know, you have taken a decision that says, my life is better spent trying to, you know, figure out what the true problem is, rather than solving homelessness or, you know, solving poverty, whatever. You know, there was a really interesting debate that I saw recently between a grad student who did this terrific dissertation on homelessness and was trying to, you know, reach policy solutions, and a professor who had a very sort of structural take on this. And whatever policy solution the grad student suggested, the professor would say, yes, but this isn't getting to the structural root of the problem. This isn't getting to the structural root of the problem. And the grad student would say, yes, but the people that I work with, the homeless people, the people I've studied, they just want a bed for the night. Mm. You know, so I'm not saying, obviously, that we shouldn't look at the structural roots of the problems, but I am saying that by doing that and only doing that, you are not providing people beds for the night in whatever small way sociology can contribute towards doing that.
Let me play devil's advocate on that, because and it's not entirely devil's advocate, because I kind of think this. Some of that feels kind of like saying we don't want to be sociologists, we want to be public policy professors. Mm-hmm. And that's a fine and honorable profession. I don't have anything against them. But it's also not what we do. And, you know, we could make it a little bit less loaded. Like, let's say that I spent the rest of my career doing calculus to find equilibria involving supply and demand. You know, you could very realistically say, well, that's a, you know, legitimate form of inquiry. Or even more extreme, let's say that I spent the rest of my career collecting beetles and trying to identify taxonomy between beetles and, you know, figure out clades of relationships between beetles. You might say that there's nothing wrong with entomology, but it ain't soci.
So
in what sense does this turn us into a different discipline?
So the reason I disagree with, so what you're doing is you're basically drawing a very hard line between, say, theoretical approaches to the discipline and practical approaches to the discipline. And the reason I don't think that that is an accurate description of how science works is that we have plenty of examples of cases where that is not how it worked. So in this essay, I give a couple of cases. There's this sociologists of science give this example of Louis Pasteur, whose research on he was doing this very practical research on you know, how do you prevent I think it was beetroot alcohol from souring, and it led mm-hmm. to these very important advances in the germ theory of disease. And then more recently, there was this very, very practical research into something about yogurt. They were investigating yogurt, like, you know, something very, very marketable, very practical. And it led them into these advances that have basically resulted in, you know, CRISPR, the gene editing technology. So mm-hmm. This idea that to be a discipline that is sociological, that is theoretical, we have to sort of avoid practical concerns, I think is empirically not the case. There are at least some practical concerns that actually lead you to better understandings of society. I was also going to say that I think it actually will lead to more ambitious sociology. I think that one thing it's very easy to do in sociology today is to sort of find a quirky, interesting research site, describe it, and, you know, just sort of do nothing else. And, you know, it's description is absolutely necessary. I'm not saying anything against description as a scientific endeavor. It's obviously the basis of all science. But I think it is possible to do more. And I think we actually challenge ourselves if we try to do more than just describe, you know, if we try to sort of actually figure out, well, what are the mechanisms that led to this problem? Why do people think it's a problem? You know, what are the mechanisms of change that are available in this society? How is it possible to, what are the structures, what are the processes that sort of tinker with these mechanisms? I think that all of those questions are actually much more ambitious and harder questions that could actually lead to better theoretical conclusions.
See, I don't know. Okay, so I want to agree with you in saying that, you know, an even more primitive example of practical applications leading to a breakthrough is t-tests, which are kind of the basis of all regression analysis, were derived because somebody needed to figure out how many batches you needed to test in order to do quality control on beer. Student worked for the Guinness Brewery, and that was a pseudonym because they considered it a trade secret.
Right.
That's awesome.
So even if you don't like stout. Where I wanted to disagree with you is you're saying, like, well, we could focus on mechanism, but, you know, you were at this interaction between this grad student and this professor talking about homelessness, but you're saying, like, oh, we can focus on mechanism. At least as I understand your relation of the professor's objection, it was like, well, you're giving us practical solutions, but where's the mechanism? It's like, which is it, right? Are we just saying, like, well, here's something that works. We don't need to care why it works. It just works and it solves a problem for people. Or is it?
No, the professor's objection was actually more that these practical solutions aren't solving the structural problem, which is a complaint that you often get about, you know, these sorts of incremental solutions. And, you know, I think...
It gives this person a bed for the night, but it doesn't get us any closer to full communism. That's kind of the objection.
Yeah, that's one objection. And exactly. Yeah. And I think it's an important objection, right? You know, so it's a sort of, is problem solving just a sort of, ameliorative sort of thing. And I think the way to think about that is, to think about the kinds of incremental solutions that can lead to structural change. You know, so for example, there's this research suggesting that, some kinds of policies will make the recipients less likely to vote, for example, whereas other kinds of policies make them more likely to vote. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that's the way to sort of talk about that.
All right, Monica, before we let you go, can you just give us a little bit more information, where to get information on this workshop opportunity, who to contact?
So we will have up on the podcast this link where you can find the email address. So the deadline for applying to the workshop is September 30, so a few weeks. And you should send your application to Miri Eliyahu, whose email I guess we can put up in this this link that we're going to have up here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And when the show goes up... So if you're listening to it at the time it came out, check our Twitter feed at Socianix, and we'll have a link to Monica's program.
Let me just, can I read out Miri's email address? It's it's MIRIELIYAHU 2014 at u.northwestern.edu. It's probably easier to just find it on the web link.
You can check us out, check out our website, theannexpodcast.com. We'll put a link in the blog section as well.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.